Persecution, trial, and tribulation. The Church of God the Eternal presents the number 22 tape in this series of vital and intense interest to every Christian. Your speaker will be Mr. Raymond Cole.
So I want to get into the subject once again. And I told you, if you'll recall now, some time ago with respect to this subject, that you were going to find it more applicable than almost any other thing that I could deliver. You're going to find it more relevant, and you're going to find the contents more significant and meaningful day by day in your lives. My dear brethren, I think we are at that point. We're going to begin to realize some of the values of things that have been said, if we have taken them to heart, and if we're cognizant or aware of those basic principles that are involved in this long series of textual material now, which has been given to you on trials, tribulation, and persecution. For our life encompasses all of those things. That's why we're here. That's why we exist. Because God is weighing our reactions and our responses to those conditions. You know, we can be a Cain, as I've said so many times, and we can bemoan and complain about all the circumstances that confront us, with which we are troubled or perplexed day by day. That's what Cain did. Cain said, "Oh me, woe is Cain because of all these trying circumstances." And God said, "I know, Cain, but I made you thusly, and I told you to master it." He said, "I'm the one that made you with that nature, a nature that is subject to all these whimsical circumstances, these unique problems, these unique circumstances with which we're confronted day by day, because they are the devising or the making of men." And God said, "I know, I made you that way. But we can listen to the still, subtle voice of the one that influenced Cain and be adversely affected by ourselves, or we can become the antitype of Abel, who had the same nature to resist, who had the same problems that Cain did. The only thing is, he handled them differently, because he was a perfect master over that nature. He did not subscribe to that nature. He did not allow it to dominate in his life. And so the circumstances with which he was confronted became the medium by which he manifested the character that God found pleasing and acceptable in his sight. Whereas the other individual found them as the source for complaining, or just plain belly aching, if you don't mind the vernacular, and the unique problems and the difficulties with which he was confronted. So it's what we do with it. We're all going to encounter circumstances. That's life. That's nature. That's what it's all about. but you're being weighed on what you do with them. And so I have come to recognize this perhaps more than ever before because of my study, long and arduous study, into the principles involved in this subject at hand. And I'm well aware, brethren, that they are either your making or your undoing, as well as mine. Now, shall we do with them? So, God has written the historical record. That's what the Bible is. The historical record of others who have encountered the same experiences and what they did with them. Either successfully mastering and overcoming or crumbling under the weight thereof. Which will it be in our case? We have to evaluate our own lives. We cannot blame somebody else. We can look and say, oh, if it hadn't been for so-and-so, I wouldn't have encountered this, or I would not have been troubled by that, or this problem wouldn't have been a unique difficulty to me, or whatever the circumstance may have been. But let us remember that God is the one who has allowed all circumstances. For if he didn't want you to go through it, he could have kept you from it, but he didn't. So every circumstance is an opportunity for those who have willed to be obedient. And so I have in my own life prayed so many times when I have seen myself fail, as I do in certain areas, and it become extremely distressing and upsetting. And I have actually prayed, and I mean more than once, God Almighty, please do not remove that from me until I can learn to master it. Because all it did was point out my weakness. And if I ask God to remove it before I overcome the weakness I'm asking to have removed from me, the only means by which I am made cognizant of my weakness and my problem. And God would not have given me the trial or the difficulty if he did not want me to see it and to overcome that unique problem. Now remember, God gives us the trials and the circumstances, according to the 11th chapter of Hebrews, as he wills or as he pleases. He chastens every son whom he loves. Is that not what he says? In the 12th chapter, pardon me, not the 11th, and verse 11. Hebrews 12 and verse 11, he chastens every son whom he loves. How does he chasten them? You know, he doesn't reach down and get a little whip, you know, and come down and say, naughty boy, you know, and so on. He uses physical circumstances. And we get chastised. Now, chastisement is useless unless we learn out of it. And so when we recognize the value of it, and we see our own innate weaknesses, then we can go back and say, please, God, don't remove it. And I'm going to be very frank with you. Although I pray for you, and I pray very diligently and hard about it, I also ask God never to remove the circumstances until you learn your lessons. Do you know why? I want in God's kingdom, but I don't want to be alone. Every one of you that fails only diminishes a part of my expectation and my hope. Jesus Christ had an awesome love for humankind. Do you know why? Because he wanted to share that kingdom with you. He doesn't want to be there alone. Remember, he qualified and he's capable of ruling the vast universe without any one of us. But he didn't want that. He wants to share it with you. And before he can really share it with you, you have to have the character that won't allow you to abuse it. So he's going to give you awesome power. He's going to give you inherent glory. He is going to give you awesome potential. But he isn't going to do it until you know what to do with it and how to cope with it. So that's the reason for the trials and the experiences right now. That's why we're going through these things, brethren. When we learn that, when we recognize it, we can challenge and defy every thrust of Satan, the devil, and of his cohorts, because that's the means by which he destroys us. You know, he's going to give up if he finds out that every time he administers a trial or a problem to break you, you turn around and use it, like the one fellow said, you know, every time you get a lemon, make lemonade out of it. So every time Satan throws out a barb or hurls a brick bat at you, you turn it around and make it an opportunity for growth. He's going to finally say, wait a minute, all I'm doing is aiding in the progress of their overcoming. And then he isn't going to like it. So he may leave you alone. So if you don't want the problem, the thing to do with it is to use it effectively then. And then Satan will flee. That's what the Bible says. He'll flee from you. Because he cannot stand that kind of mastery and overcoming. You know why? Because he failed. And it says, if men love darkness rather than light because their deeds are evil, what do you think about Satan then? He can't stand the brilliant light of God's way of life and the perfection of character manifested by those who overcome. He can't stand it. So he'll flee. Men don't like to be around where other people live righteous, holy, character-filled lives either, do they? Because it distresses them. It troubles them. So they get out of there. All right, brethren, we have some very, very significant responsibilities. All right, I want to get back now to this word that we have been covering, because there are many, many things yet to be said. And it isn't useless if we'll just take a hold and gain the necessary things out of it. So we were covering the word tzar, T-Z-A-H-R. One of the words that means trial, or a difficulty we're experiencing. So I want us to turn now to 2 Kings and the 6th chapter, and let's begin in verse 1. 2 Kings 6. And you're going to note many of these examples, the very historical examples to which I have been making reference. 2 Kings 6, and let's begin in verse 1. And the sons of the prophets said unto Elisha, behold now, the place where we dwell with thee is too strait for us. So we have to be able to differentiate trials and circumstances. And the reason I'm bringing this out is that there are trials that are manageable, that are because of the physical arrangement that perhaps is not acceptable and needs to be revised. Now you will notice the word straight here is this T-Z-A-H-R, tzar. In other words, it was too restrictive. It was too confining. And there was obviously some form of difficulty arising out of it, or otherwise, why would they have effected a change? And so they were troubled and perplexed, you know. I'll read it to you from the Living Paraphrased Bible here. It's really not a translation. But I think it will explain if you will see beyond the fellow's interpretive approach here. Here in the 6th chapter of 2 Kings, verse 1, one day the seminary students came to Elisha. Now he used terminology that he understood, and I'm not sure is applicable whatsoever, but it is language we understand. So one day the seminary students came to Elisha and told him, as you can see, our dormitory is too small. Tell us, as your president, because Elisha was over, it actually should have been translated the College of the Prophets. So here was a place of training and so on. And he said, the dormitory is too small, or wherever they were staying, and whatever the circumstances were. Tell us, as our president, or the leader of the College of the Prophets, whether we can build a new one down beside the Jordan River, where there are plenty of logs. All right, he told them. Go ahead. Please, sir, come with us, someone suggested. So they wanted him to have a direct involvement. And I want you to notice a rather unique characteristic here. Here was the president of the College of the Prophets. But the students said, we don't want to do it on our own. We want you to be personally involved. This tells you where the real servant of the people should be. Not in a far-flung operation doing his own will, but with those and the responsibilities that were to be borne or carried out. All right, I will, he said. When they arrived at the Jordan, they began cutting down trees, but as one of them was chopping, his axe head fell into the river. Oh, sir, he cried, it was borrowed. Where did it fall? The prophet said. The youth showed him the place, and Elisha cut a stick and threw it into the water, and the axe head rose to the surface and floated. Talk about living proof of God's intervention and substantiation. So here was an act that was absolute proof of God's approbation or approval. So here was a time and a circumstance when the prophet listened to the appeal of the students, because circumstances demanded it, and God gave his approbation and approval. So there are times, my dear brethren, even when we bear responsibility, we had better be attentive to those over whom we may have a responsibility, and our ears had better be open. And so the axe head rose to the surface and floated, and Elisha said, grab it. And he did. So there are legitimate circumstances, but we must differentiate by all means, because we cannot possibly carry out the expectation of the trial if we do not know the course of action expected. Supposing Elisha had said, forget it. I'm running things around here, and I will come up with the ideas and the timing. Then Elisha would have been wrong under this circumstance. So Elisha then recognized it as something acceptable to God, and God gave his stamp of approval to it. So trials can go one of two ways, and one is a 180-degree turn from the other. So sometimes it's a trial which we must master by suppressing it. The other is a time when we should listen and we should respond. Can we differentiate? We have to hone our faith, our wisdom, the Spirit of God as it manifests itself in our lives and the lives which we live. Next, I want you to notice Ezra 4 and the first six verses. And I'm going to read from the Living paraphrased version here. Ezra, the fourth chapter, and I want you to notice the first six verses. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles had returned and were rebuilding the temple. Now notice, the enemies of Judah and Benjamin, who had been sent back by God, if you'll remember the former story. These were enemies now. And if they were the enemies of the people that God had chosen, then they were the enemies of the purpose of God, whoever they were. And let's not worry with that. The term enemy here is the T-Z-A-H-R, Tsar. So it not only refers to the actual trial or the difficulty, but also, nominatively speaking, it refers to those who are the creators of the problems. So it can be subjective, it can be objective, and it can also be both nominative or in the adjective form can refer to the situation generated. So here they were, the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles had returned and were rebuilding the temple. They approached Zerubbabel and the other leaders and suggested, "Let us work with you." Now, what I want you to notice is that oftentimes people who want to join hands with you in a particular function may not be right-hearted. Not always. We've experienced that many times. Have you not? Those sometimes who want to help you, I don't mean simply because they don't know how, because of an innate weakness or something of that nature. I mean because of deception. Their hearts are wrong. They don't have a right attitude. They're not headed the right direction. They're not right-spirited. "Let us work with you," they said, "for we are just as interested in your God as you are." Now, what I want you to notice is that all too frequently, people, when they talk about God, talk about it objectively. Or perhaps I should say, in a negative sense, subjectively. It is never our God. They never identify themselves with the problem. But they always say, "Can we help you with your problem?" You get the point? True and genuine people are always a part and parcel with you. They never insulate themselves. They never isolate themselves. Or they never finger point. Because even the Bible says that when one suffers, we all suffer. Which means that if you have a problem, so do I have a problem. Because I'm one with you. But if I view it as your problem, then I'm not one with you. And here is how these enemies viewed it. They said, "Why, we're just as interested in the work, just as interested in your God as you are." That tells you immediately that they're not just as interested. Or otherwise, that one God would be their God. And the problem of those people would have been their problem. Now, can we evaluate? "We have sacrificed to him ever since King Esarhaddon of Assyria brought us here." In other words, these were some renegades. And if I get the picture correctly, I'm not absolutely sure historically, but I get the feeling that these were renegade Israelites or Judites, one or the other, that who knew and who understood were in exile but were returned. However, they subscribed to the principles, the philosophy of the country where they had been taken captive. And now they were taken back, but they identified themselves as superior to those lowly human beings that did not come up to their standard in intelligence, in wisdom, the acceptance of society, the intellectualism of the time. But these poor, crass, stupid people that didn't have enough sense to recognize the way things is, you know, in the modern 20th century, the up-to-date conditions and the up-to-date circumstances. Now, isn't that the very attitude that is manifested today? Don't they feel sorry for people who really trust God? They even feel sorry, basically, for anybody who even mentions the name God. But there is a progressive thing in that whole principle. They feel sorry, more sorry for those who have a true relationship with a true God than with those who accept merely the name of God, but have accepted basically the philosophy that is pronounced or enunciated by the God of this world. And that God, of course, is a form of intellectualism. their own prowess, their own integrity, their own greatness. And that's why it is so antithetical to the principles of the will of God. And you'll find that whole comparison over in 1 Corinthians, and chapter 2. Well, let's say first chapter 1. 1 and 2. Because he has not called the mighty of this world. And chapter 2 shows you that the intellectualism of the world of that day or of this day cannot comprehend God. It can't be done. So here they are. They said, why, your God, have we not known him since all this time? After all, we've known him as long as you have. And do you realize that Jesus Christ recognized that same thing in his day? For who was it that came to him and said, after all, you know, our forefather Jacob drilled this well, you know, and did so and so. The Samaritans, if you will remember. And they claimed that their true God was the God of Israel and of Judah. But they were renegades. They were perverts. They had known the truth all right enough, but they had bought the philosophy of the world. And that's what they were trying to do to Jesus Christ. But Jesus Christ called their hand. He knew what they were up to. So here were these people creeping in. And they came up and said, let us join hands with you. And you know, we're going to experience that very thing. And yet sometimes some of our people get caught in that. Because they form an attachment with somebody else that is not predicated on absolute truth, but upon emotionalism, personality, or whatever it may be. And if somebody ups and flies the coop, then their hearts get upset and distressed and troubled because they feel that somebody else has badly abused or mistreated somebody else. Nobody has mistreated anyone. But what we had better recognize, the only safe guide is that profound truth that God gave to us, and that truth has never varied. We all knew it. We all understood it. And we better not let ourselves be torn asunder by those circumstances. They're going to come and go, my dear brethren. There are going to be those who can't get a hold of themselves and who can't live up to the high calling that God gave to them. There are going to be those who have come in for no other purpose than to destroy. And there are going to be those who manifest that character, that continuity of purpose, that faithfulness, and will refuse to give in whatever the cost may be. The trial is upon you and me now. I mean, we're in the cauldron of fire. I don't think it's coming. I think we're in it. Although I think it's going to get worse. A lot worse. So we may have a number of people. Because if truly we are the people of God, and I verily believe it, or otherwise, as I was thinking coming up, I don't know where they are. I wouldn't know where to turn. And the proof of it is, as I've said so many times, that God Almighty said there was a body to whom he gave that truth. And out of that body is coming apostasy with a handful that would remain faithful to God. Few there be that find it, said Jesus Christ, of this very period of time. And yet, brethren, there are those who are going to falter because they do not have the character. But are you going to lose your hope of salvation because a close friend tied to you emotionally falters and doesn't make it? Are you going to give up? Or what if, more adversely, somebody comes in, wheedles his way in, and gains a strong emotional tie with a number of people? Remember, they're coming in for a nefarious purpose. And if they're coming in with a nefarious purpose, then obviously they're going to manifest the very best behavior possible. So they effect a strong tie emotionally. And then somewhere down the road, they begin to carve away at your faith and your confidence. They begin to say certain things to create doubt or suspicion. And then ultimately, feigning great injury and pain as though they have been hurt, they fly the coop. And they pull some unsuspecting souls. Will we get caught? It's already happened to us a number of times, brethren, and it isn't finished. Nothing has pained me more than to see those people fail. But were they predicating their future on some expected perfection on my part? For I'm usually the fall guy. I didn't do this, or I didn't do that, or I somehow, whatever it is. And I've already told you I'm not perfect. But I wonder if they're struggling as hard to master themselves as I try in my case. There isn't a human being on this earth that could even remotely approach, you know, in a negative sense, the vengeful, hateful attitude that I have toward myself. I abhor it. I wish I could be perfect. But if you're going to predicate it on that expectation, you've got the wrong objective anyway. You're headed the wrong way. You'd better predicate it on the perfection of Jesus Christ, which has already been revealed to us. That way of life that we know and understand. And then it'll never change. I'm struggling for it too. And so, like that young fellow who was waiting to get married because he had never found the perfect individual, so to find out she was waiting too because she was waiting for the perfect man and she didn't find him. So, brethren, we'd better not be looking to one another and for perfection in one another. We'd better be looking to Jesus Christ because he is perfect. And then we won't have any problems. So here was an example then of somebody that crept in. And they did their level best. Let us work with you, for we are just as interested in your God as you are. Sounds good, doesn't it? Beautiful words. If they had any depth. But they're like tinkling cymbals and the sounding of brass when they have no foundation under them. And so, brethren, our expression of love and respect for one another and for the truth of God had better be predicated on a whole lot more than what we see here. For we are just as interested in your God as you are. Always, always out and away from the individual. How come we're just as interested in the one and only God as you are? But you see, they didn't identify themselves with that God. There are usually telltale evidences if we're alert, if we hear. And I think back on some things that happened just a few years ago and how these words ring in my ears. But Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the other Jewish leaders replied, "No, you may have no part in this work. The temple of the God of Israel must be built by the Israelis." Well, you know, as I said, forget, you know, his reinterpretations. Get the principle out of it. It's going to be built by the people of God, in other words. That's what he's saying. It's going to be achieved and accomplished by the people whose motives are right, who are honest. And I'm not kidding you, brethren. God's going to read those motivations. And if you're true and genuine, but just merely make a mistake, then you're going to still be the recipient of them, but you're going to be also the gainer thereby. But if your motive is wrong, the day is coming when reality is going to show you for what you are, or me, or any individual who comes with a wrong spirit or wrong attitude. And I want to tell you, that's going to be an awesome day. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. You know why, brethren? Because the motives weren't right. Because people didn't have the true faith. Because they were attempting to deceive or to gain advantage, or they were opportunists, whichever the case may be. No, said Zerubbabel and the other leaders, you may have no part in this work, little fledgling operation or whatever it is. God himself determines the size. We merely live up to expectation. The temple of the God of Israel must be built by the Israelis or by the called and chosen of God, let's say, just as King Cyrus has commanded, or as God ordained in our case. And so it will be done. Then what I'm saying is this, that the trials, even though there are people who come to us, and they may manifest a certain interest in us, the trial is upon us to determine the motivation of that individual. And we judge every person progressively on the basis of that undivided, unalterable, eternal purpose. How are you going to do it unless we have firmly made that resolve and established that eternal purpose in our own minds? Because you're not going to, if you have a variable standard, you're going to get a variable product then, aren't you, on the other end? But if your standard never varies, then the product is always weighed against that invariable standard. We have been given that standard, and we know what it is. So we can evaluate the pros and the cons all the way through, and we can evaluate individuals, although we give them all the opportunity in the world to manifest the true character and to fulfill God's expectations. So, there's a satanic thrust always, an attempt to gain entrance, but always the end result is to divide and to destroy. To destroy from within. I can't help but at the present time think in larger terms concerning certain fundamental organizations that have been established in the world that look so good in the present day 20th century wrapper. To wit, the National Council of Churches. Now, let's just forget, you know, our prejudices, because that's what people would call it, you know, our basic understanding of what the whole thing is. But let's just view it in the broad objective sense as the world views Christianity for a moment. And we would think a National Council of Churches, now that must be an awesome, prestigious organization. Yet, my dear brethren, the historical facts are that there isn't anything blacker than the National Council of Churches, even from the standard that the world accepts as Christian today. Engineered and created to destroy the very concept of Christianity, period, whatever you call it. Also, the same may be said concerning the World Council of Churches. The very satanic, or that is, the very God of this world, Satan himself, is the engineer of both of them. And the intent is to destroy the very thing that ostensibly they foster. But the same thing is true of education. And I won't get into education today because I've just picked up enough in the last two or three days that could curl all the remaining hair. I make no promises otherwise. But I tell you some of the things that years and years and years ago were thought out with respect to education that are actually implemented today are harrowing. You know, I've heard of the prestigious NEA for years, haven't you? the National Education Association, one of the most prestigious organizations, one of also the most powerful organizations. You want to know how black its history is? Sometimes, you know, as I read and study these things and so on, I wish I didn't have to, because it just curls me. And then I've got to come to grips with my own emotions once again, you know. Because you get to looking at these things and you just want to blow everything wide open. I can understand why certain people who do not have any orientation become, crusaders. What other avenue do they have? But even those crusaders do not realize the extent to which they're a part of it. That is the subtlety of it. They're all ready to tie into education. We have crusaders all over this country. They want to review textbooks and so on. We have crusaders in religion because they recognize certain things going on, but they do not even realize that they themselves are a part of it. That's the subtlety of it. The same thing is happening to people within God's true church. That is the most tragic part of it of all. The fact that the vast majority of them are still tied into a principle that was created and designed to destroy. And then the same thing carries over into a few of them that depart, and they make their level or their greatest efforts to destroy even us. And you're going to see a lot of it. So, brethren, what we see here in a historical example is not new. That principle is being carried on day in and day out today. The Bible is of no meaning to us if we don't see its relevancy. If we can't grasp that the same God is the engineering force today, if we do not grasp that human beings are equal prey today as they were in times past, but that the principle implied by the God of this world is exactly the same. And the Bible tells you that. And yet we go back and look in history and we call it dead history, inanimate, as though it has no relevancy, no meaning, no significance today. Let me assure you, brethren, that what you find in here is predicated on absolute principle. Yes, I recognize it as history. But it is history that is absolutely foreordained of God, because it is underlying spiritual principle is to happen in our days and in any other time that human beings live. It's always going to happen. And then for them to turn around, which is one of the most damnable black lies that's ever been told, that after all, that was only for ancient Israel. It's a history for ancient Israel. And that's the way they got out from under it. No, it isn't. It's a history of human beings in opposition to the truth of God. That's what it is. And it is destined to be repeated over and over by human beings until they learn that lesson. All right, next I want you to notice Nehemiah, the fourth chapter. Nehemiah, the fourth chapter. And I'm not going to take time to read it, but in verse 11 you will find exactly the same word. In verse 11, but you read Nehemiah 4, 1 through 12, and there is the history of Sanballat, if you will remember. When they were doing the work of God, reconstructing the circumvallation, the wall around the city of Jerusalem, that they entered in and they attempted to do their level best to become a part with them, using all their subtle charisma, using all of their personality to gain entrance inside of the group and then to destroy from within. Another classic history of it. It's been repeated over and over and over. What do you think the whole principle is today with respect to this black Babylonian system that is emerging in the last days? What they have done is used the principle of infiltration to get within, to become part and parcel with them, and then subtly destroy from within, to break down the character, to destroy the force of conviction or belief. In one way or another, to lessen the strength of the fabric, with the ultimate intent, eventually, of destroying it altogether. That's the intent, that's the purpose. Here is the whole history of it. And the Bible is the recorded history of all the various attempts of that same subtle force engineered by Satan the devil to get into and to destroy everything creditable, all basic principle, all conservatism, all honesty and integrity, to destroy anything that has fabric and that has force and vitality. That's the purpose behind it. And if we're not real careful, brethren, we will allow our minds to become prey to that divisiveness. That's why the force of God's way of life must stand tall and firm. And if we don't permit it in our lives, then we're going to crumble with it. And God will seek even the stones to fill up our shoes if we can't do it. But God has called us. God has revealed the truth to us. God has made known to us a priceless way of life. Now it's up to us to go on from there. Next, I want us to notice Psalms 119. Psalms 119. And I want us to begin in verse 137. Psalms 119 and beginning in verse 137. And I'm going to take time to turn to it because he changes verses so much in this translation that I'll need to refer back to the King James translation here for the verbiage. Here in Psalms 119 now, beginning in verse 137. O Lord, you are just and your punishments are fair. Your demands are just and right. I am indignant and angry because of the way my enemies have disregarded your laws. Now, why did they disregard it? You see, David was not upset with the Chinese, nor the Japanese, nor the Orientals of one ilk or another. He was upset with people that knew better, and they turned away from it. I am indignant and angry because of the way my enemies, and the term enemies in this very verse, have disregarded your laws. I was thinking also as I was driving up, because it does trouble me deeply when people come into a close relationship with God's truth and then they don't have the character to hang on. You know, I would be extremely troubled in my own case and ask, you know, what kind of a wretched, miserable character am I if these people went out with a right spirit? And I mean, they did not accuse anybody. They would not malign. They did not use deceptive principles. They did not lie. But that they manifested the true character of God, I'll tell you, I'd be deeply troubled. But you see, what I see is the exact opposite. They vilify, they manifest contempt. You see, that's why I don't have any qualms about that relationship that exists between us and our former affiliation. Because a true servant of God does not lie, vilify, manifest hate, and verbally abuse like they do. I'll tell you, if I heard that they were only praying for us and they were deeply concerned about our departure and they never resorted to any lies and that they absorbed a great deal of our liability and guilt, I'd be troubled. But the exact opposite exists. where they have stood in the pulpit and they have lied to the nth degree about you. Now, no lie is of God. And I couldn't help but think concerning some of my own brothers and sisters who have been taught, I guess, to manifest nothing but cardinal disrespect for parents, which gets under my skin just like it did here, who do not even honor an aged mother and call that of God? What does God do? Violate one law in order to substantiate another one? Who is it that gave the law, thou shalt honor thy father and thy mother? I didn't make up that command. God Almighty did. And yet an organization that demands they forsake their parents and manifest no respect whatsoever. Why don't they live the truth of God if they are the people of God? How come I don't see those fruits? The days, my dear brethren, when I remember being taught that even though parents ridiculed, even though parents said all kinds of evil, contemptuous, and hateful things about us, that we were told and we taught, I taught, that you take the bull by the horns and you go manifest that courage and that respect. Because God makes it obligatory. I wonder why it isn't being lived today. Yes, I am indignant and angry because of the way my enemies have disregarded your laws. I have thoroughly tested your promises, and that is why I love them so much. What he means is he tried them. I too, brethren, have tried the way of God, and I haven't found God wanting. On the contrary, I'll tell you, if I were to mention the blessings of God, I guess next year wouldn't be long enough. And there are times when I sit down and think about it that I can't hold the tears back, and how God has blessed us. You've been the recipients of them, my dear brethren. Are we going to forget those things? I am worthless and despised. You see, David recognized what he was. If I saw this kind of an attitude manifested, I'd be troubled with respect to my relationship with my former affiliation. But I don't find that. I don't find that at all. I'd like to hear some of them just say, well, you know, we've been cursed. As a matter of fact, it's interesting that I heard one who was responsible for many of the changes make that a very statement on a tape and then turn around and say, but that doesn't mean we don't have the truth. Yes, he said, we were awesomely blessed for 40 long years. When we had all those wrong doctrines, now we got the doctrine straightened out and it seems that we're under a mighty curse. But does that mean that we don't have the truth? No, we have the truth now. How are you ever going to find out? You're blessed when you don't have the truth and you're cursed when you do have it. That makes sense, doesn't it? I have thoroughly tested your promises. And that is why I love them so much. I am worthless and despised, but I don't despise your laws. And so am I, brethren. I'm anything but what I ought to be. But I want to assure you, my dear brothers, that I do love the truth of God. Your justice is eternal, for your laws are perfectly fair. In my distress and anguish, your commandments comfort me. So, brethren, we are going to go through distress. We're going to go through unique problems. But you know what our comfort is? The truth of God. What God gave to us. That way of life. The perfection of that way. the awesome and the mighty blessings that God has given to us. Your laws are always fair. Help me to understand them, and I shall live. I am praying with great earnestness. Answer me, O Lord, and I will obey your laws. Save me, I cry, for I am obeying. Now, he was experiencing adversity, but he was being tried with respect to continuity, perseverance, and faithfulness. Save me, I cry, for I am obeying. Early in the morning, before the sun is up, I was praying and pointing out how much I trust in you. I stay awake through the night to think about your promises, because you are so loving and kind. Listen to me and make me well again. Here come these lawless men to attack me. And they're going to attack you. Don't forget it. But you are near, O Lord. All your commandments are based on truth. I have known from earliest days that your will never changes. Look down upon my sorrows and rescue me, for I am obeying your commands. Yes, rescue me and give me back my life again, just as you have promised. The wicked are far from salvation, for they do not care for your laws. Lord, how great is your mercy. Oh, give me back my life again. My enemies are so many. They try to make me disobey. See what they're trying to do? They try to make me disobey, but I have not swerved from your will. You see, God may allow these enemies to come along to see if you're going to minimize, if you're going to compromise, if you're going to turn from that perfect way. Will you compromise with it? Somebody has it in the last days. And the main organization apostatized. That's what the Bible says. Forget names. All I'm saying is that there was a church in the last days, and the church was going to apostatize, and there was only a handful that was going to remain faithful. That's what this book said. Now, if this isn't the one, then where is it? And if it is the organization and it is yet to transpire, will we be capable of handling it? Those are sobering and serious questions. But what is their test? They desire that you should follow in their footsteps and turn away from it, to compromise with truth, to give up. You see, if there's any one thing they hate, it is your faithfulness. For the brilliant light of your purpose makes them look ridiculous. They hate it. They loathe it. They're deeply troubled by it. The correct attitude in trials can be well understood in Isaiah 49, verses 18 through 23. Read it. Isaiah 49, verses 18 through 23 will tell you what the correct attitude is, how you should view trials, and what you should do about them. Brethren, in conclusion for this morning, let me assure you trials are coming. But once again, you're being weighed and tested on how you handle them. It's what life is all about. If you'd rather lay down your life than to compromise, you can be successful on the other end because you're going to pick it up. If you compromise to gain your present life, you may lose it tomorrow. It's your choice.
persecution, trial, and tribulation. The Church of God the Eternal has just presented the number 22 tape in this series of vital and intense interest to every Christian. Your speaker has been Mr. Raymond Cole.